of love we meet for the world anew.
Welcome to Muffin Talk. And welcome to Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk is a weekly radio program to which I invite guests to talk about their work and their passion for issues on social justice, Bible studies, interfaith, or community programs. Today I have invited Rabbi Dean Shapiro to a Zoom recording for a broadcast. Rabbi Dean, a warm welcome and hi to our radio program.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be with you.
Rabbi Dean Shapiro is the rabbi of Beth Shalom Jewish Progressive Synagogue in Auckland. In addition to serving the Beth Shalom community, Rabbi Dean is also involved in the Joseph Project for the Global Future, a training ground to prepare clergy people to lead their communities through climate change and crisis. Rabbi Dean, you are a rabbi of the Jewish Progressive Synagogue in Auckland. For our listeners who are not so familiar with Jewish communities, could you explain to us what it means, the progressive Judaism? What is it?
Absolutely. So when we say that we are progressive Jews, I hope someone will hear first that we are Jewish. We are part of the global Jewish community and of the flow of Jewish history. People who are progressive Jews are fully and completely Jewish. At the same time, because we are progressive, that signals that we acknowledge that Jewish culture has evolved over time. In fact, it is that evolution that is the core of our resilience that has allowed us to be an ancient people all the way through to being a contemporary people. The Judaism we practice is not the same as the Judaism of 200 years ago or 2,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago. As culture changes, as time changes, our Judaism evolves with it. Which is to say that as modern people, we acknowledge certain truths about the ways we live. We live in integrated societies, next door neighbors to people who aren't Jewish, who are our neighbors, who are our friends, who are our family. We live alongside technology and understand that that is both a blessing and a curse, but it is part of our life and how we live. We accept the absolute equality of all sexes and genders. And do not say that certain roles within Jewish life or synagogue life are reserved for certain groups of people and not for other groups of people. And at the core of all of this is a belief in personal autonomy, by which I mean that the individual has the right to decide what's right and true for their own life, rather than deferring to the rabbi or the text as holding authority over them. So as a progressive rabbi, I am a guide, a help, a support for people as they are making choices about their life, but I don't dictate to them what they can or cannot do. And that is one of the primary distinctions between us and Orthodoxy, who holds the authority, whether it's the individual who holds the authority or the rabbi or the text. As progressive Jews, we hold with Rabbi Mordechai Kaplan that the tradition has a vote, but not a veto. We get to decide what's right for ourselves, for our community, and for us as individuals. I will also add that both progressive Judaism and Orthodoxy are responses to modernity. Jewish people lived very different lives as pre-modern people, in that we were severely limited in the social roles that we could play. So that when modernity came and emancipation came and Jews were released from the ghetto and allowed to go to university and hold any jobs, it makes sense that Judaism evolved in that moment. And progressive Judaism was one of the ways that it did so, which is to say, to embrace modernity and to integrate it with the way we live as Jews.
Thank you very much for this explanation. I really appreciate that.
Oh, absolutely.
I think that it's important that we know what we are talking about, and because of what we are going to say now, the Joseph Project for the Global Future. You are directing this project, and I've never heard of it, so I'm very interested in learning more about it. And yes, please let us know what it is.
Well, it's a very small project. I'm not surprised that you hadn't heard of it before. It's really an initiative that was born from my frustration and optimism. As the rabbi of a synagogue in Phoenix, Arizona, in the United States, I found myself getting more and more dismayed. Especially because we know what's going to happen to the climate and to human life as climate change becomes climate crisis. Arizona currently has something like 75 or 90 excessive heat days per year, and it's expected that within the next several decades, that will go up to, I forget the numbers now, 120 or 150 excessive heat days. We are in Arizona, we are in drought because of the Colorado River.
Can you explain what an excessive heat day is?
It means that there is too much heat for too long, and that has a detrimental impact on the body. In summertime in Arizona, temperatures are regularly 45 degrees, and not just a peak, but they're sustained at that. Nighttime cools off, but it doesn't get cool. It stays hot. So if people don't have air conditioning, or if they have to work outside, or if they are vulnerable in any way, including being elderly, being children, having certain conditions, they are really at risk from all sorts of health-related conditions that are exacerbated by the sustained high heat. And part of my job, a wonderful part of my job, is to welcome new babies and to bless them and give them their Hebrew name. And if they are a boy, to be part of Brit Milah, ritual circumcision. And this is wonderful. But time after time, I would hold that little baby and the whole family was beaming with joy, of course. But I tried to think ahead to when that baby was 40 years old or 50 years old or 60 years old. And knowing that if they stayed in Arizona, they would be experiencing times of difficulty, perhaps extreme difficulty, I realized it was not enough just to say, have a wonderful life. We love you. And so I thought long and hard about how I would acknowledge the reality, not the expectation, not the fear, but the reality that children born today are going to experience the difficult side of climate change. And so I thought about how I could refocus that ritual to remind parents that they have an extraordinary obligation to raise this child to be part of the solution, to play some small role to make the world better. And then I had a sabbatical coming and I thought, okay, climate is the number one issue that is confronting us. It is a moral issue. It is an economic issue. It is a theological issue. I've got some time to think deeply about what this means. And I looked for retreat programs and teachings and books, and I didn't find too much. I certainly found Jewish organizations that were working on climate mitigation, meaning that they were trying to lobby the government to enact better policies, working with corporations to do the same, all good work. But as a clergy person, I recognize that I have a distinct role as the leader of a local organization. And there was really nothing sustained for me to develop those skills. There was a weekend for clergy with farmers here, or I could go to New York to hear a lecture there. But it wasn't enough for me, especially given the gravity of the situation we're facing. So I approached a couple organizations and I said, hey, could we start something like this? And they said, that would be a great idea, but we're not the right place for it, for all sorts of good reasons. And I got frustrated and then I got optimistic and I said, well, then let me try. Let me see what I can do. And so I am working to launch a training program for clergy people of all faith traditions. Certainly not only Jewish. This is a global situation and we need to work together to help clergy people get ahead of the curve to the extent that we can. To think, as I say, theologically, what do you say on the Sunday after your town's been flooded? What do you preach? What do you tell people? Or when a 5-year-old or a 75-year-old says to you, Rabbi, why did God do this? You need to have an answer. And so we need to spend some time thinking about it, but not just theologically, also organizationally. We have a structure, a synagogue, a church, a mosque, a temple with resources. Can we partner with the Red Cross or disaster relief agencies to help them anticipate when there are disasters of one form or another? We are a community that speaks the same language, both literal spoken language, but also symbolic language that knows the same stories. How can we use that reality to educate one another, to train one another? We have physical plants, buildings and grounds. How can we use those to withstand what's coming better and to teach people what's possible for them? It's also climate change is global, but it's also extremely local. What will happen in Phoenix, Arizona is not what will happen in Auckland, New Zealand. So it doesn't make sense, I don't think, for Judaism as a whole, not that there is such a thing, but the church as a whole to make policies. It's each local place that needs to adapt and figure out what's next. So that's what I've been working on. I have been very pleased to be working with an American organization called Blessed Tomorrow. It's part of Eco America, an ecological focused organization. It focuses on religious people and trains them to be more climate savvy, trains churches primarily to respond to the climate crisis. And I approached them about creating materials for pastors and for clergy. And they've been really very terrific and have asked me to partner with them. So that's the work that we're doing. And I hope to find a way to do that here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, if I could get a group of pastors, of clergy to work with me, that we could do a learning session together, a learning series together. I would love that.
I think that we will be able to do some connection with the Religious Diversity Center. And we had about 2 years ago, we had a series of 6 hui together with Religious Diversity Center and Auckland Emergency Management to look at how can we support the communities, how can the communities work together in case of an emergency. And as I understand, you're not looking at advocacy work, which is also important, but you're looking at what do we do when it happens? And so how can we mitigate the changes?
Well, all of that is it is all part of it, right? Okay. Disaster relief is vital, and we need to think about our physical plant and how can we be ready for when disaster strikes, when the cyclone strikes. Is there something we can do now to be ready to house people who need it? Can we store emergency supplies? Are we the right place for that so that they are accessible when they're needed? That is all true. But I'm also thinking about things like this as we talk about the physical plant, the building and the grounds. What should the landscaping be? For example, if you have just lawn, just grass, it doesn't absorb much water. But if you have wildflowers and meadows, it absorbs a lot more water. If you have trees and tall bushes, even more water. Now, most individual churches don't have a lot of grounds, although collectively we do. But if we were to change our landscaping and communicate to our community, to our families, this is what we're doing and here's why we're doing it. And if you want to do it, we've got a group of teenagers who would help you do it because they're committed to the environment. Then all of a sudden, it's not just a 4 square meter patch, but it's more and more and more. And our neighbors see it and we become a little more resilient. I'll give you one other small example about my synagogue in Phoenix, where, as I say, it's so very hot in summer. And of course, we had air conditioning. You have to. And we had water fountains all throughout the building and on our inside courtyard. But it suddenly struck me that we actually should have put a drinking fountain on the outside so that people walking down the street would be able to get a drink of water. When the building was created, no one was thinking that way. But that type of thinking needs to be part of our work now, of our understanding now, so that in coming decades, we won't have to say, oh, if only I had put an overhang there or a drinking fountain there. We'll think ahead to what we know is coming and start to put the infrastructure in place now.
So that was one of the ways how you can adapt today by with your example of the water fountain outside. Do you have any other examples that you can think of where we could do something to show that we are forward thinking?
Well, storing water, of course, is very important. And I will share two more examples. In Phoenix, there are quite a number of people who are unhoused, who are homeless. And the local churches and synagogue, we were part of this, had a housing program where homeless people knew that on Tuesday night they could sleep here, on Wednesday night there, and they would be fed. That's not unusual. That's a beautiful thing. But the churches and synagogue and mosque got together to buy a mobile shower facility that would go to the parking lot of every church on this night or that night, and so people could get a shower as well. Well, as climate gets worse, and as crises come and people are kicked out of their houses, whether for 2 nights or 2 months or longer, what are they going to need? They're going to need food. They're going to need clothing. But you don't always stop to think that they're going to need a shower. So if I were to build a new building now, I would want to create some shower facility. It doesn't have to be flash or private, one person, but I would want to take that into account now. The other thing that I am aware of here is, of course, the rain. And as lovely as it is to have outdoor space, I would want the capacity to put a roof over it. One, so that we could use the space in winter, right? That would be a good thing. But also, if I have people who are suddenly without a home and I need to find them a dry place, I want to have more dry place to provide for them. So those are the types of things that we can think about in terms of physical plant. the stories we tell, the wisdom we transmit from generation to the next. This is part of it also.
You're talking about clergy and you're talking about faith-based communities. How could our adaptation as people of faith be beneficiary for the wider community? So you gave some very practical examples, but what you just mentioned could be done by any building. You could have a fountain outside, you can have a shelter outside, but what can the faith communities do that is beyond what anybody else can do?
Beautiful question. First, I will say that there is something special about a faith community or community center providing facilities like this. And that is that we are incubators and seeders, S-E-E-D-E-R-S, which is to say that the 50 or 500 families that are part of that community see the project, understand the benefit because they listen to the rabbi or pastor, they pay attention to what she has to say, and then they might go home and do it themselves, and then their neighbors might do it. So by changing the landscape at a church rather than, say, a business center, we have people who are invested in it and who might bring the ideas from place to place. So that is one place. But another is that climate change and crisis is going to raise for us substantial issues of justice and equity. How do we look after vulnerable people? What are our obligations one to the other? When resources are limited, how do we share them? Well, as religious people, we are heirs to great wisdom, to traditions of discussions, of questions just like this, because our ancestors have gone through times of want and times of need, and they blessed them, wrote down their experience. They recorded that wisdom and pushed it forward to us, knowing that sometime it would be needed and now's the time. So by asking ourselves the moral question, by tuning our moral reasoning, we and our children will be better citizens of a more unjust future because we will be beacons of justice at that time. But you can't just instantly get it right. You have to role play and hear the stories and absorb the symbols so that you're well equipped when the time comes.
I like the fact that you are referring also to the memory and of the history, because I just think the Jewish communities and the Christian communities, we're going now through a time where we talk a lot about memory and about our history of our faith. So that really connects. And what can we learn out of the history? Because it's not just for the books.
Absolutely. I will just tell one brief story. The Talmud, so we're talking now 1800 years ago, tells the story of two men who are in the wilderness when they realize they only have one skin of water and it's not enough for both of them to get to the city. And it asks the question, what do you do with limited resources? How do you think about how to use them? Well, we should be asking that question. It's a powerfully applicable question right now. The power of ritual and the power of grief. Many of us are feeling the sadness of knowing that this beautiful way of life we have been living is changing. And many of us feel a responsibility for that. And so it is appropriate to lament. Now, lament, the expression of grief and loss, is not a big part of Western society today. We are focused on amusement and consumership and youth. Well, our religious traditions know how to beat our chest, how to create space for us to name our hurts and our losses, And I think that that skill, that liturgical space, that ritual space, is going to be more and more necessary in the coming decades.
I think that that's absolutely right. And it is the lament is, I think, in many religions, but and it's important to think about things and to have that comfort. I think that when you talk about an emergency, and if that was one of the points that came out of the Hui when I was attending one of the Hui with the emergency management, Auckland Emergency Management, one of the points was that people said, well, where do we turn to when we're grieving? We have lost a lot of things. So we turn to our church, our mosque, our synagogue. So that's our faith community that is important. But I just thought of that quote by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, who said, we do not inherit the earth from our parents. We borrow it from our children. And I think that's a quote that you can identify with, isn't it?
Absolutely so. In fact, my sermons these last High Holy Days, the Jewish New Year and Day of Atonement, were about how to be good ancestors, that we are here as the heirs of the choices, good, bad, and both, that our grandparents, great-grandparents made. And that we need to understand that the choices we make will impact our grandchildren and, God willing, great-grandchildren, whose names we may never know, whose lives we may not understand. But if I live my life thinking that my choices only impact me, well, then, of course, I'm going to throw a party. I'm going to eat steak. I'm going to take airplane trips. But if I pause and say, you know that steak you're eating? If you eat that, your grandchildren will go hungry.
Yeah.
Even a little bit. The soil won't produce as well for them. I don't mean specifically this for that. You're having a negative impact, not on the unknown, unnamed future, on your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren. Well, that gets me thinking and puts me in different relationship to the future. And it really is based on my sermons and thinking were based on the book that was called Becoming a Better Ancestor or Being Good Ancestors, that was deeply impactful for me.
Yeah. I think even if you don't have children, you still have the responsibility of the children of the world.
These are metaphorical descendants. We understand as adults that we are responsible for all children. I will also say I'm aware of the time, but your question reminds me that as religious people, we are trained to think in larger chunks of time, not just the now, not just the hour, but to think more broadly about the year, the decade, the century, the generation. That is part of how we function in the world as religious people. And that's a skill that we can share with others because it's needed now.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Dean. And I think that we could continue for a long time. But we are going to hear more from you soon. And it will be available on the RDC website. And just quickly for Titipona Mo Study and Joy, we do have a session coming up, which is a special request, an online session on Creation of Adam from Whenua. And this is with Dr. Christopher Longhurst. And it will also focus on not just Christian religion, but other religions also. And we are looking at the Bible and Whenua, of course, with the Te Ao Māori. So that will be on Saturday, the 1st of April, so tomorrow, 9 to 10:30 a.m., and it's on Zoom. So thank you very much.
Sounds great.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Dean, and I wish you all a good Friday and a good week ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Of love we meet for the world a new day dawning and shines a light to greet. like to reveal.